Johnny Gowdy. Yeah, my gator went haywire when you walked into the room. Anyway, that's my own new theme music I wrote for myself on ukulele for the beginning of the show. First, there'll be a song. Then I'll sing a little song to myself. How are you doing? This is episode 18. I'm Johnny Gowdy. I'm your host. This podcast is called How Did I Get Here? My guest today is Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's, from the Blue Bonnets, from the Text Tones, from a lot of bands you'll hear about. You'll hear some Go-Go stories. She's a good friend of mine. We've played together. I just kind of did the math. We didn't really talk too much about it, but I've played with her off and on for fun and good times since 2007. I did a show with her band, and then I started this all-girl band, and she played guitar in it, and I love playing with her. I love her guitar playing. I love her musicianship, and I love her personality. She's a person that's kept herself challenged and really really a lot of fun to be around, and a good pal. That's a good way to describe her, and she's one of my favorite people. Anyway, what's been going on? I've been getting some good response from all you guys. I've been getting more and more, so thank you for the emails. People seem to really like a lot of these. Sometimes I interview your favorite person, and then you hear about the podcast, or maybe you know the podcast, and you learn about a new person. So it's working out for everyone, and I'm having a good time doing it still. And it was Kathy quite a few months ago that I first was, not at first, but one of the first people I talked to about it, and she was very encouraging. And she actually talks about it in the podcast. Anyway, so Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's and the Blue Bonnets, a good friend, and she came by the apartment today, and we're talking. I'm sorry I'm not out. I took my field recorder out, and I tried to find something like an ice cream truck, but I found nothing. So deliberately going out and trying to find stuff to get into is kind of lame. That ice cream truck just drove by yesterday, so we lucked out. There'll be more. Here's my guest for episode 18. Two dogs. They're over at my ex-girlfriend's house.
Oh.
That's where they live.
Oh.
That was a terrible fade on that, wasn't that?
I didn't
get a little bit more professional with it. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. What's going on? You just got off tour.
Yeah, I did a tour and just kind of, you know, I always feel behind. I guess everyone does. Do you always feel behind?
Yeah.
On everything?
Yeah.
So I kind of like, every day I just get up and try to catch up, and I'm starting to kind of realize I'm never going to catch up.
Yeah.
I think that maybe is what my life is about, is just being behind.
Yeah.
So rather than ever thinking I'm going to catch up, just get up and do stuff without thinking of it. Like,
yeah.
So that's kind of, I'm going through some philosophical musings like that.
It's good.
Trying to make me more okay with how things are.
I think that's what everybody's doing. Maybe yeah. It's just everyone's kind of getting, people I know are getting that point in their life. They're reassessing and kind of figuring out what's important.
Exactly, yeah. How do I spend my time? Because we don't know how much of it we have.
Yeah.
Well, it started off dark.
That's me. Dark and deep.
That was the Blue Bonnets. Are you guys going to be playing now that you're off the road with the Go-Go's? Or
well,
from the Go-Go's?
Well, you know, it's like we don't really have a drummer, and our favorite drummer lives in Los Angeles, but now she's moved to Chicago, and there's just such a shortage of female drummers, and we like the vibe of it being all female.
Yeah.
We like that and want to keep that intact. And the one or two that are in Austin, they're just so busy and always working.
Right.
And so it's kind of in the way because we'll get someone and we'll get a gig and we'll rehearse and go play. But you know how a band is. It's got to, you got to just play a lot together.
Yeah,
I got a new song.
Let's,
yeah. And otherwise it just starts feeling like just stagnant. And, not quite. I mean, it's always fun to play.
Right.
Even if you're playing a bunch of old songs, it's fun to play.
Right.
But, you know, I kind of want to, move forward with the Blue Bonnets and
right.
I feel a little stymied.
Huh.
Or stymied.
Stymied. I like that word.
Stimmy, stymie.
What is that? Is that a Yiddish word?
No, I don't think so. It's one of those words, though, that you read it before you say it. So you're never really, like, to me, like, I used to always read Ari. That's A-W-R-Y. And I thought it was Ari. But I would say Ari, thinking that they were two different things.
Oh, that's weird.
Took me a long time.
Wow.
To go, oh, Ari is Ari.
Ari.
Stymied is stymied.
Yeah. Stymied is stymied. Stymied is stymied and Ari's Ari.
There, I go from dark and deep to completely inane and
totally zany. Kathy Valentine.
Yeah.
So were you born here in Austin? You were?
Yes, at Seton Hospital.
Yeah.
But it was an old brick one down on 15th, I think.
Yeah.
And they tore it down.
Oh. Now it's gone.
Gone.
So how old were you when you first heard music in a way that it spoke to you?
I think when I was, I remember being really like young, like 3, 4.
Yeah.
And really liking the Beatles. And the other one that really struck a chord with me was Herb Alpert.
Yeah. Wow.
And
that's where the zaniness comes from.
I mean, we'd go to this coffee shop and they had, you know, the little jukebox that on the table.
Yeah.
Where you could flip through.
Yeah.
And I'd just be flipping through, looking for any, you know, Taste of Honey, Lonely Bull, whatever
right.
I could find, or any Beatles.
What was the first record you ever bought, like with your own money, where you heard a song and you went like, oh, I need to buy this album?
I don't know if I have the first one down, but I remember having my little box of 45s and, you know, carrying it around.
Yeah.
And it had Sugar,
yeah.
And... na 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 hey and there was just I might have the eras mixed up, but there was a little period and my Sharia Moore,
yeah,
that's when I was really buying. It was all, you know, top 40 stuff.
Yeah.
Tommy James, just whatever was on the radio.
Yeah.
And I think that was pretty much my music deal until I was in Lubbock. I used to go to Lubbock a lot. And when I was about 11, I was there and my cousin AJ was playing. He was just holed up in his room playing over and over and over Sunshine of Your Love.
Yeah.
And it was a real awakening. You know, I've quoted this many times because it really, I think it's what you're asking. It's
just that
one song that all of a sudden you realize that music can affect you in a different way than
right.
just kind of bopping along to it on the radio.
Right.
And that song, I mean, he just played it over and over, and I was just like on the other side of the door going, wow, what is this? And then, you know, concurrently, the Beatles were kind of getting a little bit more, you know, and
yeah.
I was aware, I was always aware of them and kind of was tracking their progression, and they kind of got a little bit more where it affected, you know, it wasn't so much I want to hold your hand,
right,
but it was like come together,
right,
and stuff.
Some stuff that was really like moved you.
Yeah. So that was a changing point.
When did you start playing an instrument?
I started with violin in grade school.
That's not something you wanted to do, was it? Was it something you picked out?
I did pick it out. Really? Yeah, I remember, I don't know if it's still like this, but you got to go into the cafeteria and decide whether you wanted to be in band or orchestra and pick your instrument. And I picked violin, I think, because my grandfather played violin, but I never really connected with it that much.
No.
No.
What? When did you pick up, like, guitar? Was it guitar first? Or
well, no,
first?
I went to piano, okay. And one of my biggest regrets is that I stopped playing piano. I started playing guitar, and I was kind of doing a little piano, a little guitar. And the piano was very formal, like reading music, and the guitar was just, like, learning some chords and playing them. And for some reason, as I got a little further with both of them, I just was more drawn to the guitar.
Right.
And that's, I was 15.
Yeah, and you started playing guitar. And then you've told me the story, but was it going to see, why am I drawing a blank on their name, the Joan Jett and Cherry Curry Band? The Runaways. Was it going to see the Runaways that you were like, oh, wait, I can do this? Or did you already have
a band?
No,
I was already playing. What the real, another pivotal thing for me was, I'd begun playing guitar, and I was learning some folk songs. I had a little nylon string acoustic and this and that, and I just hadn't really thought about rock star. I liked the Stones. I loved Mick Jagger, but it didn't really dawn on me that a girl could be a rock star. But I was in England in the early 70s, maybe 71, 72, and I saw Suzy Quatro on Top of the Pops. And that's blew my little mind.
Yeah.
It was like, whoa. And from then I wanted an electric guitar, and I thought I was the only girl in the world that was doing that. And then I heard about the Runaways, and I didn't see them. I went to see them because I knew already who they were. But when I heard about the Runaways, I was like, oh, I'm not the only one. And I thought they were going to be like my sisters.
Yeah.
So when they played at the Armadillo here in Austin, I went, you know, running backstage, and the first one I ran into was Lita Ford, and I was like, hey, I play guitar too. Like, she was like my long lost compadre, and she just looked at me like, and I think she even said like, yeah, just like she didn't care. But a couple of the other girls were much cooler, and I kind of hung out with them, and I went back to the Round Holiday Inn where they were staying.
Oh yeah, the one on the lake.
Yeah. And years later, when I was in the Go-Go's, we did a van tour. And I remember we got some beer to take in our room, in the hotel room. And I went to the ice thing. And this is what I'd seen Joan Jett do. So I went to the ice machine in the hallway, and I got the bucket of ice, and I filled up the sink in the hotel room and put the beer. And everybody was like looking at me like, whoa, what a good idea. I'm like, yeah, this is how you do it, man. You know,
this
is how you be a rock star. That's how Joan does it.
That's how you learned it.
Yeah.
So you had punk bands here in Austin, or what? Like, what was your first band?
Well,
I
was going to a school out in Bastrop that was a free school, and a bunch of us kids, we put a band together, and we played at some of the school benefits, and I think we called it Childhood's End. We were always trying to figure out a name, and from there,
it's kind of a heavy name.
Yeah.
For a first band.
Yeah, and then my friend, my best friend, she wanted to be the singer, and it's funny. I was struggling with the girl drummer thing even back then. I was like, no, you have to be the drummer. We need a drummer. So she started playing drums, and we found a bass player, and so we wanted to be like the girl ZZ Top.
Okay,
and
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and Van Wilkes gave us our name, and he called.
How did you know him?
I don't know, because I was always going to clubs and stuff.
So you were out and about, and you were seeing music.
Yeah, as a teenager, yeah, I would. They were really loose. I mean, it wasn't like you got carded.
Right.
I didn't.
Right.
So he came up with the name Lickety Split for us, which is pretty nasty sounding, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. But
for what we were trying to be,
if you're
like
trying to be a dirty
chick,
rock and roll band,
yeah, chick trio.
It's a great name.
So we opened for him at the Two Bitter, and that was my. That was the early Kathy.
What kind of music were you playing?
Covers, like the bass player was really good, and it was a trio, and me and Marilyn weren't very good at all. But gosh, I don't remember what we were doing, really.
But you weren't writing then or anything. You were just playing.
No, I was writing.
Oh, you were?
But I don't think the songs were that good. Okay. I don't think we were doing any of them. Not that I recall. But, and then Meryl and I went on to start a band called The Violators, which was, I went to England. But in between that time, I went to England. I was 17, and there was a fledgling version of the still intact band Girl School.
Uh-huh.
And
it's kind of a metal band,
right? But they weren't then. They weren't sure what their direction was, but they had an ad in the Melody Maker and for a girl guitar player, and I answered it.
While you were there?
Yeah, and I was 17. I went trucking off to play with these girls, and I was really blown away by there was like a whole like neighborhood of chick musicians. I couldn't believe it. I mean, next door to us, there was this girl that had like a giant orange afro,
uh-huh.
and she played through an orange amp stack.
Wow.
And just like the visual of this chick, this like really hip chick with this orange afro and the orange stack. I was just like, whoa. You know,
yeah. So you
in Texas, there was nobody like that.
No. And I guess over there, like, I guess they had Lita Ford, or not Lita Ford, Susie Quattro. Did the Runaways do better over there? So it seems like music was always a lot cooler over there when things were kind of
there was an era, I think.
Yeah.
So I joined them and just did that for the summer and. For a couple of boring reasons, I ended up coming back to Texas. And while I was there that summer, I saw some punk bands and decided, you know, I'm going to go back to Austin and start a punk band.
And you did?
Yeah.
That was The Violators?
Yeah.
So what was that? What was the...
We did some originals, but we did a lot of covers too. We did Pretty Vacant, and we did Sex Appeal by Iggy Pop.
Right.
And we had a pretty... What else did we do? Gosh, we did some originals, some really dumb originals. And we thought we were really, really special. You know?
Right, yeah.
We were pretty full of ourselves. And I just knew if we got out of Austin and went to New York or LA that we'd probably be big. So that's what I did at 18.
You went to L.A.?
Yeah.
You packed up The Violators and you went there, or you just went there yourself?
No, me and Marilyn went, and then our other guitar player, Carla, she came a little later because she was more mature and responsible, and she wanted to have a job in place before she went taking off to L.A. So anyway, we didn't last long. We broke up once we got there.
Oh. And then you started the Textones?
Yeah, started the Textones.
What was that like?
That was me and Carla and a couple of guys that we met at a Capitol Records swap meet. And
it was like Capitol Records swap meet.
They used to have in LA the Capitol Records building in the parking lot every Friday. They had this massive record swap meet. It was awesome. And it went to like almost 4 or 5 in the morning. So everybody would go to the clubs. And after the clubs, you'd just go to the swap meet on Friday night. Or whenever it was. It was like, but it was pretty regular. I might be remembering it wrong. It was either every week or every other weekend. And it was just insanely great because.
Sounds great.
Yeah. It was a networking place. And everybody that was there was either a musician or a club goer or a music fan. And it was just a way to kind of extend the night. And we met Peter Case there from the Plimsolls.
Yeah.
And he didn't have the Plimsolls then. But we introduced him to Eddie Munoz, who was, you know, a fellow Texan, and he introduced us to our drummer.
Wow.
So it was just, it was a scene, you know, it was a really good scene in LA right back then.
Yeah.
Like 79. It was really good. There was you know, punk bands and rockabilly bands and skinny tie new wave bands. And
yeah, they all played together too. I remember that.
It was really good.
I remember when it was, it's funny because you were talking about how you'd never seen the Runaways earlier, you know, but you had heard about them. And a lot of people, I guess over probably 35, remember a time when you couldn't on demand see everything by
YouTube,
you know what I mean, like now you can just immediately like get to it, and there's these moments that are lost, like the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, Mm-hmm. Like that moment doesn't happen really anymore. Someone's going to play on Saturday Night Live. That moment doesn't happen. You can just get online after it's on and watch it, you know.
Yeah. And I was really dependent on the magazines, you know.
Yeah.
They played a big part of my world, you know, Cream Magazine.
Yeah, and Circus.
And Trouser Parade and all.
Hit Breeder.
Trouser Parade. Hit Trouser Press. So, yeah, that's where I had seen pictures of them. I couldn't wait when they came to Austin and played.
Right. Well, I remember a lot. The first time I saw a lot of bands, not the first time I saw the Go-Go's, because I guess I saw it maybe after this movie came out, but I'm thinking that it's from around that time, that movie Erg Music War.
Yeah, that came out around 81, I think.
Okay.
Or it was filmed in 81. I think it came out, actually, I don't think it came out till after I joined the band, because I remember being kind of irritated because the
I'm not in it. Okay.
And it's because they filmed it,
because I remember they looked different. Like I remember specifically Belinda looked a lot different than she did when I first saw the Go-Go's.
Yeah, but I was pretty snobby about my chick musicians at that point,
because
when I saw the Runaways, I was real not upset, but I was not really into like the whole like hot pants and corsets and all that. I just I didn't see why that needed to be a part of the thing.
Right.
And
like that Tanya Tucker album cover or something.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
And when I saw the Go-Go's for the first time when I was in LA, I thought that they were just terrible musicians and just kind of clownish.
Right.
And I was kind of...
Was it all of them and not you?
It was
at that point?
There was not Gina either.
Okay.
And when I saw them, you know, months and months later after Gina joined the band, it was a different, I mean, literally that girl makes the band.
Man, I'll say this. I never realized her strength and power until I saw you guys just, you know,
I'm telling you, I've always thought that pretty much we could go out and work without any of us.
Just kick ass.
I mean, there's been... We've done benefits where Belinda wasn't available, where Jack Black sang or someone, you know, Beck sang, or we've done things with someone else singing. And of course, we couldn't do a tour like that.
Right.
We've done it.
Yeah.
Exene sang.
What is that? What is that? Is there any video available of like Jack Black singing with you guys?
I don't know. I don't know.
That sounds amazing.
It was awesome. And, you know, we did a tour with Vicki Peterson filling in for Charlotte. They did six shows with my Dominique filling in for me. Jane's mom got sick on a couple of years ago.
And Eve
filled in. So we've been able to pull off shows. Well, there was one time where we thought in this past tour where Gina hurt her neck. And we thought, well, we can't cancel. We've already canceled a year before. So let's be ready to have someone take Gina's place. You can't.
Yeah.
I mean,
no,
I just couldn't believe. I mean, I couldn't believe what a difference.
So were you in the Textones when you first
when
saw them?
When I first
them?
Saw them, yeah.
Did you guys do shows together?
No, we weren't really. The Textones were more in the kind of, we were in a different circle. We played a lot with like the Plimsolls and the No. But, I remember I had a 21st birthday party, and I remember Belinda was there, and because some of the Blasters were at my party, and it was the first time I got in Rolling Stone, because Robin Zander was there. And,
no way.
Yeah, it was this big, like, kind of, for me, it was like a big celeb fest.
Was it at a club? Or,
yeah, it was at a club.
Cool.
Yeah, so, and my manager, he set it all up. I don't know how he pulled it off. But it was a big deal, and it was really cool. And Belinda was there. But I didn't really know those girls at all.
Right.
I mean, when Charlotte approached me to see if I could fill in for their sick bass player, that was the first... Oh, actually, I take it back. Gina, one time, me and Carla were looking for a drummer for the Textones. And Gina, before she joined the Go-Go's, she came to meet us. And we thought she seemed too much like a hippie.
Oh.
Yeah, so we didn't even consider her, which is, like, really funny.
That is funny.
Because she went in to try out for the Go-Go's, and they, like, yeah, we'll take her, and they, like, totally give her a makeover.
So, they cut her hair and, like...
Yeah, they cut her hair and ditched the overalls and the wire-rim glasses.
Yeah. Man, so when they came to you, Charlotte came to you?
Yeah, yeah. Because they knew who I was. And
How did that go? What was it?
And the reason they knew is because when the Runaways were in Austin, I made, besides making friends with Joan and another one of them, Vicky, right. I made friends with their roadie.
Right.
And when I got to L.A., he was working for the Go-Go's.
Okay.
So he... And he was one of the only people I knew. I knew him and some guys. There was this band called The Plugs, and they had played at Raoul's.
Yeah.
And they were El Paso guys, but lived in L.A. So anyway, the Go-Go's roadie, he suggested me.
And
Charlotte saw me one night and said, "Hey, we need you. If you can play the bass, can you play the bass?" And I said, "Yeah, I can play the bass."
How do you play the bass?
No. But I figured I could.
Yeah. And you could?
Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
Anyone can play the bass.
Yeah. Well, there's some people that add magic to the bass.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not everyone can do it well.
Right,
but,
right.
You know.
But anyone can play bass. Yeah, yeah.
Anyone can do anything.
So so then what happened? You got in the band. What was where was the band at the time?
The band was popular. My first show, it was like... And the Textones weren't popular. I mean, we did plenty of gigs where there was, you know, 40 people in the room.
Right.
You know, our big thing was if we got to open for someone at the Whiskey or something. So, but the Go-Go's, they weren't opening for anybody. We were doing two shows a night for three nights, including a New Year's Eve show. And every show was sold out. So, you know, I'm 21 and I'm thinking, this is what I came here for.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is more like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
And I had quit the Textones. I wasn't in the I was really flopping. I didn't know what to do. I hadn't been happy in the Textones. I'd been like 4 months of flopping. And so this seemed like just like my, you know, it just seemed like the ship was sailing by very slowly. And it's like, you jump on.
Yeah. Before it goes too fast.
Yeah. So I did. And, you know, I was pretty...
Were you guys like going out on the road?
No.
So
it
you
was
were
like,
just kind of playing in L.A.?
Yeah, well, the first order of business was to make it so I wasn't temporary.
Right.
You know, and I guess that they were not real happy with their bass player. You know, I've never met her, but I just tried to make it my business.
That's funny. So you've still never met her?
Mm-mm. I just tried to make it my business to make sure... I was good in every way.
Yeah.
You know, but that's kind of my personality. I try to go beyond what is expected.
Yeah.
So.
You always show prepared.
I was prepared and I was good. And it didn't take long to just kind of go permanent.
Yeah.
And we played. They had done a single. They had done a single in England on Stiff. So there was, you know, a little bit of buzz around them, but all the record companies had passed. So when I joined, they had been passed on by all the major companies. And so we just were kind of doing our thing. And I was thrilled because I'd never been in a band where we got a salary. We got $40 a week.
Wow.
And
what else did you do for money?
I got unemployment.
Oh, that's good.
So I was living in a really nice house for free.
Wow. How did you swing that?
Well, I met this really cool chick and she was married to John Sebastian.
Yeah.
And so he was at their New York house and she was in their LA house and she just said I could stay there. So I did. And then she would go back to be in New York and say I could drive her car. So I was living in this really fancy house in the hills. When the girls came over to meet me, or I mean to like, because I hadn't met Jane when she came. I think they were impressed because I lived in this fancy house and I drove a nice car that wasn't mine and lived in a house that wasn't mine. And I knew Nick Lowe and knew some people like that.
Right.
And Carlene Carter was my friend. And
did she live in Austin? Is that how her connection was? Or when you went out there?
No, she never lived in Austin.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
But, and then Catherine, my friend whose house I was living in, she she knew like all these people too, and so right. I would meet them. So they thought I was like all kind of connected and
right.
And hip and stuff.
So right. how they came over and met you, and there was like the.
Well, it was just fancy, you know. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't fancy. It was just they were like really struggling, little scrappy, little
right.
You know, punk rock chicks, yeah. And I was living in a fancy house in Hollywood Hills.
Right. It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
So, so they came over and they checked you out, and everything went well.
Or yeah. Well, you jammed yeah, it was kind of weird because you know, as soon as Charlotte asked if I could play bass, I ran out the next morning and borrowed a bass. I don't even remember who I borrowed it from, but and I met with her, and she gave me some cassette tapes. And it was right before Christmas because the gigs were on New Year's Eve. So I remember that Christmas.
Right.
I spent 4 days, like the 24th to like the 28th. And then I got two rehearsals with the band. And then we played the 30th or 20th, I don't know. The three nights up to New Year's Eve. So, yeah, I think they came over. She brought Jane over to meet me. And... you know, to be honest, I'd been up for days learning these songs.
Right.
So it was a little awkward.
Right. Were they checking you out, like giving you the eye, looking you up and down? Like
no,
because you were just coming in to fill in as long as you could play.
Yeah, I don't know. It was just awkward.
Yeah.
Because they just had a big gig and they wanted it to go well.
Right.
And I was kind of wired.
So it went well, and how did you end up solidifying the gig? Like how did you end up closing the deal? I've always wanted to say that. How'd you close that deal, Kathy?
Well, I think there was probably a lot of talking, you know, going on between them. Mm-hmm. And I think the girl must have been screwing up because, you know, if it was me, you know, they wouldn't be doing that to me.
Right.
So whatever I, you know, she must have not been pulling things along.
Right.
And they just... I think at that point they'd had a taste of what could happen, and I just seemed like someone that could. I just seemed like a natural fit.
Right.
So they asked me. They called me and said, "Would you stay?" And I said, "Yeah, if I can write songs."
Smart.
Because I was smart.
Yeah.
I said that's a deal thing. I got to be able to be a writer.
Cool with that?
Or they wanted that.
Very, want it.
They wanted. They were glad to have another writer.
Yeah. So then what happened with you guys? So you got together, you integrated yourself.
We started. We did some gigs. We like, you know, went up and played in San Francisco, and we played at the Roxy. And at that time, we went to New York and played somewhere. That was really exciting. And then. Someone came, Miles Copeland came to the Roxy and decided right. he'd give us a deal. So we were all excited. That was within 2 months of me joining the band.
So you just walked in and...
Well, I could look at it like that, or I was the...
Well, no, yeah, yeah.
The final piece.
The final piece, yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, that's... Anyway, so you guys went in and you got signed, you made a record. Mm-hmm. Beauty and the Beat was the first record, or did you do a single or anything before that?
No, we just did the record. We did it in New York.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Was it a good experience? You guys get along? Was there a lot of...
It was
really exciting, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had never spent time in New York, and to be there, you know, staying in a hotel. I mean, all of it was extraordinarily special to be in New York City with someone paying for it.
Right.
And being in a hotel, someone paying for it.
Yeah.
You know, and your job is to go play music.
Yeah.
And be in a recording studio and then go hang out in clubs, and people know who you are already. And it was pretty cool. It was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me also, it was, because I'm an only child, and it was this camaraderie that was really, like, I just kind of glommed on to those girls.
Yeah.
Like, they were my family.
Yeah.
And they really felt like a family to me. It really felt like sisters.
Yeah.
And, like, or like a really exclusive club. where nobody else, everyone else wanted to be in it, but nobody could be.
Right.
So I liked it a lot.
I wouldn't blame you. So you guys made this record, and then how fast did it take off? Because I'm trying to think. I heard you guys pretty much from the first.
It took 9 months of touring. I mean, we did a whole tour with us in a van, and we played all the clubs that people play, you know, First Avenue and
right.
Minnesota and,
right.
you know, the, what is it, the... Jeez, now I'm drawing big blanks. All the clubs that were back then, Club Foot in Austin.
Right.
We did all the clubs that were bands of that level do.
And you didn't tour with other bands like?
Yeah, we did. We had Joe King Carrasco.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and we had the Rock Hats.
Who's that?
They were a rockabilly band.
Okay.
And two of us were going out with Rock Hats too.
There you go.
Yeah, so it was convenient.
Worked out.
So
how you went on for 9 months and then Our Lips Are Sealed.
Our
Lips Are Sealed was the first one, right?
Well, it was the first single,
yeah.
And I don't know what it charted at. None of the songs were number one.
No.
The album was number
one. No, but when I first saw you guys, there was a television show that Casey Kasem had.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sometimes record it on VCR because it was on Saturday mornings, and I from playing soccer, going to the Renaissance Festival or something, I would record it, and I recorded that show. That's where I first saw it. I remember sitting there with my friend Craig and watching it, and we were like, yes, yes. Like, we really, like, it, we got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember there was a couple times where most of the time it felt right and like it was exactly like it should be.
Right.
And then there was, you know, you always hear people that they get successful and then they go like, oh, but deep down I felt like I didn't deserve it.
Right,
how you hear that all the time.
Yeah.
Well, I never felt like that. I felt like I felt right. I felt like, why shouldn't this be mine?
Yeah.
But there was a couple of times where I did feel intimidated, you know, like when we got really big and going like out on stage and in an arena opening up for the Police or the Rolling Stones. Sometimes I felt like there was a couple of times where I would feel kind of intimidated, like, whoa.
Right. So once the record started to hit, you guys stepped up and started doing.
Yeah. Well, our record didn't go number, like we were doing the van tour, the club tour. And then I think we kind of got a tour bus and we toured for several months. And then Miles said, you know, girls, this is what he always do, girls, I'm going to put you on the road with the Police. And that's when things really, you know, because most bands that are good, that have, you know, the real problem is exposure.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, nightly exposure to 25,000 people.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was Saturday Night Live, which was, you know, millions and millions. I think it was like six. It was either 6 million or 60 million. I don't know. It was a lot of people watched us on that. And we weren't very good on it. It was kind of a disaster, but still.
Why was that? Was it just?
Well, we were just messed up. No,
did you guys start partying? Like once
we got there at 11 in the morning and did our little sound check. And then we kind of just stayed there, which you're supposed to do. And I think we drank something and then, it's, you know, went too far this way, some of that, go that, and then, too much that way. And by the time it was like six, we were there for like 6 hours before we played. And I think when it was time to walk out, we were all really high.
Yeah.
And it was nerve-wracking and not a good way to be.
Yeah. The music was just a little ahead of you probably the whole time.
Yeah, I don't think I don't watch stuff like that. I don't know. I should go see. Maybe it's not as bad as I remember it.
It's probably not.
It probably is.
So that was for the first record you were on there.
Yeah.
Who was the host? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was, God, what's wrong with me? I think it was Bernadette Peters.
Oh, wow.
And Eddie Murphy was on there.
Yeah. So how long did you guys tour for that record and go behind it for more than a year? Well, yeah,
it seemed like it went on for a long time. It seemed like we just played constantly, and then we had to go to Europe and play constantly, and then Japan and Australia, and it was really nonstop.
Yeah,
it was nonstop, and we got pretty haggard.
Yeah,
even being 22, 23, sure. It was we got pretty haggard.
Plus, you were hitting it pretty hard. You guys were all
We were hitting it hard.
It was such a funny thing in, I hate to reference another interview, but in the Behind the Music, I just remember, I can't remember which one of you guys says it though. It's just kind of like, here we were, these like, you know, crazy partying animals, but then on stage we were like the happy little go-go's, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
the girls next door.
Yeah, it was.
Was that any kind of like preconceived? We're gonna, you're like, we want you to be these kind of girls. You know, we want you to be this kind of thing. Or you guys, we want to be this. Was there any kind of preconception on what you wanted to be viewed as? You
just kind of did your thing. We were just ourselves, and yeah. I think that whole, like, you know, because we were young and we did have like little innocent little faces.
Yeah.
And so, when you're 22 and you're a girl, and you know, people weren't so hardcore now. You know, people didn't have like. Pierced faces and tattoos all up and down their necks and stuff. It's just, people weren't that hardcore.
No.
And we weren't a punk band, so we just looked like these normal girls. We just looked normal. So, you know, kind of pudgy, normal girls with sweet faces. So that isn't who we were, but we certainly looked like that.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I don't blame anybody for kind of the media kind of,
right,
you know, if you saw us, that's what it looked like, and so that's what we were. But you know, can't judge a book.
What were they? Were you pinned with anything then? Like, here are the, you know.
It seems like
like some kind of label, or people were like, oh, you know, this is the new.
It seemed like a couple of magazines called us America's Sweethearts. I think I saw that a couple times.
It works.
But yeah. I don't know.
So you finished the touring for that, and then you guys went back into the studio?
Yeah, they wanted to release another single, and it was a really stupid mistake. We weren't guided very well. The manager of the band had been with us since, you know, the earliest days, and she had started out as a friend, and when things were getting bigger and bigger, we just really didn't have someone kind of in charge making good decisions. For instance, you know, like even maybe not doing quite as much work would have been good.
Right.
But when they said they wanted to release a second single, I remember, or a third single.
What was the third single?
There wasn't one. They wanted to release one.
Oh, they just didn't.
And I remember all of us went, oh, no way, man. You know, they're trying to bleed us while we're hot.
Yeah.
We want to go make a new record, man.
Right. We got new songs.
Yeah. And it was just lame because we weren't really ready to make another record. And, you know, the record probably would have sold millions more with you know, another single and another single.
Yeah.
I mean, every song is not a hit, but they're all good songs.
Yeah.
I mean, Lust to Love could have been a single.
Yeah.
You know, maybe This Town.
Yeah. That's a, I mean, yeah, that's a classic album.
Yeah, maybe How Much More.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway,
so
we weren't ready, and we went in to make the second record, and it was, you know, pretty much a disaster. You know, we were burned out, and we didn't have good songs. And
Vacation's good.
Yeah, I brought that one in.
Yeah, lucky.
But you know, that I'd written that when I was 22.
Really?
Or less. I'd written that when I was 20 or 19.
Wow.
Yeah, so it wasn't like, I mean, everything we did, we only wrote a couple of new ones for that record. The rest were like leftovers from the first record, or, you know, some things we patched together.
I was in my grandma's bedroom when I first heard that song.
Which?
Vacation.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
In your grandma's bedroom?
Uh-huh, watching MTV and playing Monopoly with my cousins.
And yeah.
There was a new Go-Go song. I freaked out. I was very excited.
Oh, cool.
And I was stuck in Miami. I had to go to summer school that summer. I can't even remember for what. But it was the summer between 7th and 8th grade. And I loved it. So I guess then that was that song a number one?
No, number nine.
Number nine. Still great.
I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe the record was number nine. I don't know. I don't remember.
So what? Where did you guys go with that? I mean, what was another big tour? Because you guys.
This time we were headlining though, so we did arenas headlining, and we had all different bands. We had Flock of Seagulls and Red Rockers.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who else. You know, so we did a lot of the same places we'd played with the Police, but now we were the headliners. I got to play Madison Square Garden twice, Boston Garden twice.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Where were you guys at then? Like, where were you at personally at that point? Like, were you just kind of a disaster? Were you like feeling 58 years old when you were in your early 20s or
no,
used or?
I was, let's see. By vacation.
You're so young. I mean, you must have been 22 when that record came out. 22, 23?
22 for We Got the Beat. I mean, for Beauty and the Beat. And like 23 and a half.
Still so young, you know.
23. Yeah, because I was 25 when we broke up.
Right.
I remember that.
Wow, that's so funny. Like,
it was over.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was probably 23 and then 24 for the last one. And then we broke up.
Right. Well, so where were you at when Vacation came out?
Well, I think I was...
Were you excited because your song had been, it was being a hit?
Yeah, I was excited, but I was also, you know, we had a lot to live up to. And, you know, we knew that we would be compared and judged to our first record.
Yeah.
And,
It's the, you have your whole life to write the first record and then 3 months to write the second one.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I was felt insecure about, because Jane and Charlotte had written so many good songs. And so Vacation, like, I gave a lot more credit than I needed to, because I think I was like, felt more confident if their names were on it too. Like, see, I think I was scared that if it failed, that it'd be like, oh, her song.
Yeah.
So one of the things I did was, I mean, legitimately, you know, we had some input, but, you know, you could listen to the song before the Go-Go's did it, and
it's the song.
It's pretty much there. Yeah. So I think I was really, looking back, I think I was just like, whoa, that would have been really bad.
Right.
To fail and have it be my song.
Yeah.
You know, my single. So I kind of cloaked myself with the big writers.
Right.
You know, so that it was all of our failure if it failed. So I was, I don't know, at some point in there, I tried to start kind of taking better care of myself. And, you know, I certainly wasn't sober, but I tried to like not drink before shows.
Right.
Didn't mean I wouldn't drink after, but I tried to kind of take it more seriously. It certainly felt more seriously, you know, when you're, you know,
that's a lot. There's people that depend on you, like their livelihoods depend on you.
And,
I mean, there's a,
yeah, I wasn't blind to any of that. And you know, it's you're pulling up in a stadium with big trucks and semis full of equipment and tour buses and, like you said, tons of people working for
you.
Yeah, that's... So I tried to, you know, kind of woman up.
Yeah, woman up.
And be, you know, be somewhat of a functioning, responsible.
And how was the band at that time? Was it getting a little bit more scattered? Was everyone kind of taking their own, had their own camps and had their own...
Well, at some point...
Was it all still on one bus or...
No, we were all still always on a bus. And there was always... I mean, the situations would always arise where we're kind of dependent on each other to entertain ourselves or make something that was boring or a drag or ridiculous or absurd or, you know, insulting or whatever situation arose that, you know, there was plenty of reasons to band together and feel solidarity always. But there was also... a lot of internal problems because the inequality in money had started to rear its ugly head, and the drug addiction of Charlotte was spiraling really badly out of control, and you know, I became very focused on, at some point, and probably it was during vacation, it was like this was everything that I wanted in life, and there came a point where my job felt like it was to make sure that I got to keep this. Like, if there was a conflict,
you had arrived.
Was to make the conflict go away. You know, if somebody's mad at so-and-so, make it go away.
So that's kind of your role in that family.
I felt like I took that on because it was like more than the others. With the exception of Gina, I had been in other, they it was their first band. As far as they knew, this happened to any band that came along.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And me and Gina had both started being in bands when we were teenagers, and we'd been in bands that had broken up and started new bands that had broken up. And so we kind of knew that this was,
special.
And Gina and I kind of had that bond. And so I fought. Really, when it started to unravel, I was out with my little sewing kit, so to speak, trying to sew up the unraveling constantly. Yeah. And it was very fearful, fear-based way to live.
Right.
You know.
So you guys toured, you did all these arenas, Vacation did extremely well, mm-hmm. right? And then you made a talk show. It has one of my very, very favorite songs, Head Over Heels, and you co-wrote that.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, I wrote that.
So where were you guys at when you went in to make that record? Was it was definitely more haggard, more...
Well, there was, it always felt like a new start, you know?
Yeah.
Because things like that, you know, you're going to England, but, you know,
that's
there
where
was...
you made that record?
Yeah, we made that in England. But at that point, I think... Belinda had maybe started to think about doing stuff outside the band. You know, maybe she got approached or something. I think there was a little bit of that. And there was, you know, once again, the inequality financial issue. And there was the drug addiction and the drinking. And then there was, and then on that record, the other element that came out was that Jane wanted to sing a song on the record, and we said no. So that caused like another rift.
Yeah.
You know, so there was like, besides the other previous things that had built up, then there was a new one to add into things.
Right.
And she was so unhappy with our decision that she basically quit.
Yeah,
and said, I'll do this tour after talk show, but I'm done after that. And, you know, it was really bad, but things were falling apart all over the place that I kind of thought, well, maybe someone new will be the new glue.
Right.
Maybe we need a change. I kind of...
Did you get someone?
Yeah,
you
we did. I moved to guitar,
okay.
which is what... I really like to play and felt like I could do a good job in the Go-Go's.
Yeah.
And we hired a bass player. And we went to Rio and played a big thing called Rock in Rio.
Yeah.
And it was...
It's like the gig to like 150,000 people.
It was 350,000.
Jesus Christ.
350,000 people. And it was pretty much insanity. I mean, it was just... The B-52s and all around the pool was amazing at the hotel, because there would be like all these camps. There's the Scorpions and there's the White Snakes and the B-52s.
Right, because that festival is a lot more like
and Rod Stewart and Nina Hagen and
wow,
it just was all this mishmash of people, and there's Ozzy and there's this and so it was a really cool experience, but it was the nail in the coffin of the Go-Go's. Almost, it was one of the nails.
The last show.
It was the last show
before y'all broke up the first time.
Yeah.
So, I used to read your memoir on Twitter.
Well, probably a lot of this is familiar sounding.
Yeah. But there's points that that I wanted to get to, that your journey from reading that and from hanging out with you and playing with you is I see you as someone that's always learning and wanting to be really good. And in fact, I just had John D. Graham on here, and he was saying there's an ethic in Austin when you grow up here musically, where you have to be, you know, this big to ride the ride. Like, you have to be this good to ride this ride. And it seems like you were always on a musical journey to get better, and that you would sometimes find yourself with your heroes and question them and try and get, like, learn some from them, like Keith Richards. Was that during the Go-Go's, or was that right after?
That was after, but yeah, I mean, so
the Go-Go's break up, and you're in L.A.
Yeah, when the Go-Go's broke up, I think that's when I started reassessing. I mean, I was pretty heartbroken and devastated and lost,
right,
for many years. But when I started to pull myself together and try to figure out what the heck I was going to do, I think I started going back to wanting to be a good musician. Because in the Go-Go's, and with our success, being a good musician didn't seem to be,
right,
that didn't seem to be a big part of it.
Right.
It was more about the songs, right, and the,
which isn't bad. It's just a different, it's just a different approach.
Well, now I think it's really cool. I mean, now on this last tour we did, I loved that without any staging, any production value, yeah, any choreography, yeah, any auto tune, any backup, yeah, players or singers, that
it's a fucking good band.
That we just go out and it's the songs. Yeah. It's really the songs and the personalities.
Yeah.
And that's why we're so different. And that's what I really think is special and, yeah, awesome about the band. But there was a period after we broke up where I was like, God, you know, being a musician is about getting better.
Right.
And there was a time when we got back together where I was, you know, probably a little, you know, snobby about the fact that I had decided I was going to get better and,
right,
everyone else had stayed the same.
Right.
You know, which isn't true. You know, people, no, get better just, yeah, by doing it over and over.
Yeah, yeah.
But they got better within the context of the Go-Go's, you, right, know. It wasn't like branching out.
Right.
So anyway, but, you know, it is a journey. And for me, the journey not only is about getting better and improving, but, you know, being tolerant and accepting and recognizing and appreciating what value there is.
Right.
Which I feel like it's taken a long time, but I really feel like I've come to that place where I do recognize and appreciate the value.
Yeah.
And that it's different than it was 10 years ago or, yeah, 20 years ago.
Yeah. I get that from being around you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
So you, did you feel like you were floundering around, and then when you found what you wanted to do next, which was kind of the predecessor to the Blue Bonnets, right?
Yeah, I decided that I wanted to, that it wasn't too late to be a good guitar player.
Right.
Because when I first started, when I first, you know, saw Susie Quattro and all that, I mean, I wanted it to be like Hendrix, Clapton,
yeah,
Jeff Beck, you know, Pete Townsend, Kathy Valentine, yeah, you know, I wanted, why, yeah, shouldn't I be one, yeah, of them? And, you know, after the band, it didn't even occur to me that I could go back to that dream, because, yeah, to be one of those people, you just do that.
Yeah.
You just play that lead guitar, yeah, all the time, and you get in a band where that's what you're known as.
Yeah.
And all I'm, and still pretty much what I'm known for is being a bass player.
Yeah.
But I decided at 35 that wasn't too late to try to do, and not to be in a pantheon, but to, for my own desire. So I'm really happy where I got to on guitar. I've lost a lot of my chops since I became a mom. I don't work at it very much anymore. I work more at
I don't know. We played together last year. I was always, I love the way you play.
Yeah, but I listen to stuff I did in the early 90s, and it's stuff I can't even execute now. But that's okay.
Yeah.
You know,
we go through our phases.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, if I wanted to do that, I would. Yeah. I'd start practicing more and sitting down with my records and copping licks and all that stuff that you do when you are so focused.
Yeah.
I like that, but I got good enough to kind of satisfy that, you know, sometimes our life is just about, we get these little urges or pulls, and I just think it's kind of a crime when you don't follow, you don't have to follow them all the way to the top of the mountain, but why not let them pull you along a little ways, you know? And so I had that little urge and that pull to be a better guitar player, and I just followed it down for a while until I was like, okay.
And that's what you spent a lot of the 90s.
Yeah,
on.
I was really into playing that guitar.
And you guys toured a lot?
Did
you?
Not really.
You would come to Austin and play. That's
why
it seems to me
Austin,
that you toured.
And we got some good gigs. We'd played, go up the coast and play in San Francisco and, you know, here and there. The best gig we got was getting a gig in France. We got a gig in Paris for 3 weeks.
Yeah, the Chesterfield.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's kind of what I try to do now, is just pay attention to those little tugs. And
right.
I just feel like a life can go by and where you just ignore them, and then that might be what you regret.
Yeah.
I don't know if you regret a lot, but I think regret, I don't want to regret that I didn't follow those little tugs and pulls.
Right. Especially when you could have, you know, it doesn't take anything away from you to try something else.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going to lose anything.
Yeah.
I understand that. So, then intermittently throughout that time, the Go-Go's would get together and do something.
Yeah.
You guys did a new album at some point, in the early 2000s.
Well, we did three new songs for a retrospective, and that was sometime in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Called Beyond the Valley of the Go-Go's.
Yeah.
And we did three pretty good songs for that. One me and Jane wrote called The Whole World Lost Its Head. And that was, ironically, our biggest charting single in England.
Really?
Yeah. And we did, the record company released a greatest hit. So we got, you know, there was always reasons to get together and do stuff.
Right.
And the interest was still there, and the, you know, a lot of the bad blood had gone.
Yeah, past. Time.
Yeah.
Heals.
Wounds all heals.
Yeah, wounds all heals. So then into the 90s, and you started working on a solo album, which is...
No, I didn't work on the solo
album.
No,
not in the 90s, in the early 2000s.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, sorry.
That's right.
I messed up my decades. And so that's around the time that I met you. When that came out, you did a Go-Go's tour and then like a show here. How much did you, like, what made you do that solo album? Because you didn't sing in the Blue Bonnets. You don't really sing in the Blue Bonnets, right?
Yeah. Dominique took my place in the Go-Go's while I was pregnant.
Okay.
And we kind of had a little falling out during that time. And
you and Dominique?
Yeah. And it was kind of wrapped up with Go-Go drama and... it was just ridiculous.
Those things happen.
And it was
people
lame.
Are people.
People
you know what
are
I mean?
People.
Yeah, we all have our feelings.
Money comes in the picture, and it was just one of those things. So I was pregnant and not playing in any band, and there was this guy that I really liked named Muddy in L.A., and I always thought he was really great, so... We had tried to have a band together, and I just turned to him for a song. I said, I got a song, help me record it. And from there, I liked it. And all of a sudden, it was like I just kind of gave myself permission, so to speak, to do it. And not, as long as I could tolerate, you know, because I'm not I don't think of myself as a singer, and I don't even enjoy singing.
Right,
that
I was going to ask you if you actually even liked singing.
Yeah, I don't even like it that much. To me, it just feels uncomfortable, and it's never. It was more like so I didn't have to find a singer.
Right.
If I ever sing, it's usually just so I don't have to deal with having someone else deal with it. So that's not to say I wish I couldn't sing.
So did you?
I wish I could. I wish I could sing a lot better. I mean, and I wish I could dance.
I've never seen you dance.
I can't dance, and I wish I could paint.
Oh.
I can't paint either.
Everyone can paint.
Yeah, it's pretty ugly when I paint.
Sorry. So, how did you, when you did that record, did you sit down after you did that one song and sit down and focus and make a record and go over every day and work on it? Or was it just like
I got a little Pro Tools studio and I just.
Oh, so you kind of took over.
Yeah, I co-produced it.
Right.
So I got very, I was, you know, really focused on the material. And I think it was just because.
Were you writing, was it material you just had laying around? Or did you sit down and focus and write a record? Had you done that all yourself before?
No, I'd never done that. So, and what I found was, it wasn't even about singing or anything or about being solo. What I loved, what I found myself really responding to more than anything was after my entire life of being a musician and being a team player, band musician, to like, I could do whatever I wanted. I didn't have to.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't have to say, "What do you think? Do you like this song? What do you think?" And then have someone go, "No, it's not good." You know, or "No, I don't like that line," or "I don't like that," or "I don't like the way that is," or you know, well, if and then try to get someone else to. And so maybe if you get three people to like it, then the other two have to. But just none of that. It was just like if I liked it, I did it.
Yeah.
And if I liked a part, I did it. And if I liked that line, I wrote it, and it was awesome.
It's a whole new
freedom. I had never experienced that ever, and I think that was the whole record. What it was about for me, it was just this freedom to have it go my way.
Right.
And I learned a lot from it. I think that's where I got more confidence. I think that solo record, more than anything, it just gave me a lot of confidence to trust my musicality.
Right. And you were living in LA at the time?
Yeah. Yeah. And I realized that I was a good, really good writer, really good arranger, a good producer, that I had a lot of, I think just it wiped out any doubt.
Yeah. It stills a lot of confidence to be able to go in by yourself and do it and walk out and be like, here it is.
Yeah.
And it's good. Some of the best stuff you've done.
Because when you have someone else kind of shooting stuff down, you don't get that. All you get is that you were shot down.
Right.
So when do you get the chance to kind of
balance
that out? And if you're always in a band, you don't. You're just like, some of it flies, some doesn't. So it's like you get your confidence in little piecemeal.
Right. Yeah. There was one thing I did want to ask. And I've asked you this before, but I wanted it on the podcast. about Ace Frehley. He's my favorite Kiss member. When I was a kid and dressed up like Kiss, I was always Ace. And I didn't like confront Doc McGee, but one night I saw Doc McGee and I had one question. How can you put some dude in Ace makeup and put him on stage with Kiss and pass him as Ace?
Yeah.
He told me it was Gene and Paul's band and not to worry about it. There's nothing he could do. So
that was a good answer.
Yeah. That's exactly what he said. He said, it's Gene and Paul's band. They can do what they want. Or they do what they want.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I felt like, so how do you know Ace?
Well, I had a roommate in LA, and he was a Kiss fanatic. I mean, he was one of those fans that is such a cool fan and such a fanatic that he actually became friends with them.
Right.
And I think I had a birthday party and he invited Ace, and Ace was at my house, and I was making the record, and I just said, hey, would you play on my record? And it was a little self-serving. I knew that if Ace played on it, that there would be a lot of Ace fans that would listen to it just for that. So, and I'm never afraid to work the angles, you know?
Yeah, there's like nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, especially if
I had him play on mine, it would just be to shove it in all my friends' faces that I used to paint my face with. You know what I mean? Like, so you like Gene Rice? It's Ace! You know?
But I got some other people to play on the record, too, that I thought were noteworthy. So I didn't know if he would actually...
Who else is on there?
Well, Pete Thomas played drums.
Wow,
and
that's a guy from Elvis Costello.
Elvis Costello, yeah. And Clem Burke, of course. And
I saw him last night on The Tonight Show.
Clem?
I don't think it's from last night, but he was playing with Blondie.
Oh, yeah, they did do The Tonight Show. Yeah. And who else? Oh, my friend Craig Ross is on it that plays with Lenny Kravitz. Just, right. You know, buddies, basically.
He's an amazing guitar player.
Yeah, he was my roommate, too. But that's another whole story. So, anyway, Ace, he actually followed up, like, the next day when he wanted to do it. It wasn't like he was just saying he wanted to.
No.
So, I was working with Gilby Clark at the time, and I took Ace over to Gilby's. And
Gilby Clark seems like a nice guy.
He's so nice.
Yeah.
And Ace, like, did, like, four in a row, and me and Gilby were kind of just, like, looking at each other, like, going, oh, this isn't going to work. And then the fifth pass, it was just like a genius solo, and we just said, that's it, done.
Yeah.
And it was genius. It was like he fumbled around like four times, and then he was a genius. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's
you
good.
Know?
Four
like
fumbles?
Like he went from fumbling
just
to
right
like,
into it
to like right into. I mean, it's one of his best solos, I think, on that song.
I love his playing. I love his stage persona, especially in Kiss. Do you guys think the Go-Go's are going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? You got a star on the Walk of Fame.
Yeah.
Has there been talk about it?
Well, talk I've heard is that they don't want us. They don't think we deserve it. And it really kind of gets on my nerves.
That is such a harsh fucking thing to say.
It really gets on my nerves.
Let me just tell you something. You don't deserve to be in the club with the rest of the geniuses.
Well, you know? This year, like, Joan Jett is nominated. And it just seems like, you know...
What's the criteria?
Well...
That's a different conversation. Because they won't let Kiss in either. And that's a big problem. People have a problem. I kind of have a problem. Yeah, because kids are like, you know, they overlook Kiss. Like, how can R.E.M. be in before Kiss?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. And it's very political. And one guy... said, because Clem, he tells me stuff. He's always lobbying for us because he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he said...
He should just be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for himself. Yeah. Like, seriously, when I saw him play with you guys that night, I know he's a huge player and stuff like that, but man, he is awesome.
Yeah, well, Blondie was just here, and he's, like, so amazing. I mean, I think he's one of the best drummers of our generation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
And in his dressing room, he had his own dressing room, and he had this shrine set up in his dressing room with, like, his pad, drum pad, and his sticks, and Keith Moon, the Beatles. I mean, he had, like, this whole shrine of his vibe area.
He's so cool.
It was really cool.
My friend Benjamin saw them play a couple of years ago, and I was like, how was it? I was like, how was Clem? And he was like, oh, man, you know, he hits so hard, it hurts my feelings. So yeah, there's a so Clem lobbies for you guys.
Yeah, and I mean, someone once said, "Oh, it's because you guys only did three albums in your run
so
of
what?
Success." But you know, the Stooges, they only did three records,
yeah.
And they're in,
right? Of course.
So I don't buy that one. And then you know, and I think Joan Jett is great, but you know, her success was cover songs.
Yeah.
She didn't write any of those songs that were her hits.
Right.
And it just seems crazy to me because, you know, our influence is pretty far and wide. But whatever, you know.
Sure.
I used to not care, but now I do care. Now it's...
Yeah, it's you know.
I used to like... I don't really like award shows and halls of fames and all that. I just think it's... I don't like all that patting on the back stuff. But I think...
There's a legitimate reason why you guys would be in there.
Well, yeah, and then you get older, and you're like, okay, one day I'm going to be gone.
Yeah.
And it would be cool if there's still that thing there
to have
that there. That would be cool, you know, after you're... Because, you know, it just would be cool.
Do you guys have, like, an exhibit or anything somewhere? Or like
no,
in the museum?
No, they have an
experience museum or anything?
Well, this was annoying because they said... They said, we've got a spot for something this year. And like Jane got her guitar to them. So now it's just like says Jane Wheedlin, the Go-Go's, with her guitar. So now I'm even more irritated. I'd rather there be nothing than one person.
Right, right.
You know?
So. Yeah.
But I don't think they wanted a bass. And if they did, they weren't getting one of mine.
Yeah.
I've already sold all mine that I'm not playing. Sold them to the Hard Rocks.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Where, do you have a bass on any of the Hard Rocks
that I could go visit? Yeah, I've sold tons of basses.
Really? You sell your stuff to them? That's how you do it?
Yeah.
You don't just give it to them?
No, you sign it and sell it. Sometimes that's awesome. It's not even yours. You just go buy one at the music store. That's what they do.
I know. But they didn't do that with Elvis' costume in the Vegas one, did they?
I don't know.
Might be some regular. Just
some of that stuff doesn't look right. You know, come on. You look at some of that stuff and they say, like, this is Bruce Springsteen's shirt. And, like, the tear just looks so, like...
deliberate.
Yeah. And none of that stuff looks right to me. The boots, none of it looks right.
Right.
I don't believe it.
I don't either. No, I don't. I mean, I used to, but I just...
It's probably a mixture. It's like the jewelry thing.
Right.
Mix in some real with the fake.
Right.
And hope no one notices.
Wow. So you don't know where any of them reside? Like, we can't tell these listeners, like, go to the Hard Rock Cafe and such and at booth number 7. It's no. Kathy Valentine's bass. Only it's a Squire, like mine right here.
No, I needed the money at the time.
Well, that's good to be able to have to, you know, be able to do that.
Yeah,
I guess. Something you can...
But it's, then there's a couple, like, I sold one bass to a fan that I regret. I regret selling it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
I sold a hollow body Rickenbacker when I first moved to John Lennon one to the guy in Tom Petty's band, Ben Montench, for like $200.
Wow.
I regret that.
Was that after you were famous or
no, when
you
it was just when moved I was out broke. There?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Regrets. I tried to get him to sell it back and he wouldn't. Kind of lame, huh?
What if he charged you all this money? He'd be like, you know, this used to belong to Kathy Valentine.
He's probably going to sell it to the Hard Rock.
Yeah. Sell it as his own. Well, so where are you at now? You just did a tour with the Go-Go's. I saw the last show of that here in Austin. It was incredible.
Yeah, I'm trying to record some Blue Bonnet stuff. And I'd actually like to record some stuff for me. But... you know, the stuff that I want to write and record, I don't know if it's relevant anymore. A lot of it's like heartbreak and, you know, losing my marriage sort of songs. And I'm kind of...
It's always a good record, though, to get to make. It's a cathartic experience.
It's a good, yeah, that's what I mean. But then it's like, God, I'm kind of past it, you know? And so I don't know if I want to just kind of dwell in all that some more. So I kind of missed a good opportunity to make a good record, you know. I did a couple songs that I like, but I didn't make a whole record of but it's true, the writing thing for me, when something bad's going on, it sure is your friend.
Yeah.
You know, it
sure
just
is.
Having that just, there's something about, like, when you're just writing it, when you're just writing in a notebook, like I do sometimes, just like, and I'm just like crying and crying. And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, that'd be a good song line. Yeah. And then it just kind of stops. And it's like, then it just kind of stops and you just kind of shift.
Right.
And, you know, and then you're like sitting there with your guitar writing a song and it feels good.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, that sorrow is channeled.
Is gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's great. That's why I do it, I think. Yeah. Ultimately, that's why I've ended up doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It heals you.
It does. It's very healing.
Keeps you from going nuts.
It does.
And you don't turn that energy on yourself.
Yeah, it's your friend.
Yeah, it is your friend. So you're going to work on some new music? No shows for the Blue Bonnets coming up?
We're working on getting some shows, and I've been asked to, if I want to, put together a day of stuff for a South by Southwest party.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, but yeah, God. I mean, all that, like, rounding people up and they cancel and what do you know?
Right.
It just sounds, it's not my thing. I don't know. It's flattering to be asked, but my thing I really want to do is I want to write a screenplay. And we had lunch a few months ago. Yes. And you wanted to do a podcast.
Yeah.
And I wanted
and
to,
you
do,
to do a screenplay.
And you're much farther along than I am. I did
the podcast get a, easy. I just need to tell people to come over. I don't have to write anything.
Well, I got an outline done, and now I'm kind of in that part where I just need to make sure I sit down every day and do it. And I don't. I'm really sporadic. And, you know, I think a lot of it's fear.
Yeah. So,
but I really, I can feel it like kind of scratching to get out. Like yeah. It's just always at the back of my mind. Yeah. Like, why aren't you doing this? It's one of those things that I won't be able to ignore and feel comfortable with. So that to me, I take as a really good sign. It's,
yeah.
It's got to come out, and I'm excited about it. I think that, I think I have this feeling about it that I used to have about being in a band.
Right.
I have a feeling that I'm going to do really well.
Yeah. And it's exciting. Like the,
it excites
the,
me.
The, wow, there must be a new thing of ice in there. I'm pretty excited. Why am I drawing a blank on this word?
What
the promise
talking?
Of
oh, yeah.
something new is very exciting. Like,
yeah.
Like what it holds, just not knowing what it holds.
Especially when you have that feeling that you could do it well.
Right.
Because I think that's the problem almost. I have a feeling I could do it well, so can I allow myself to not do it well a few times to do it well?
Yeah.
Or can I be patient enough to not to have it suck, basically?
Right.
So I'm trying really hard to just muddle through. And but I do have a strong sense that this is something in my life that's going to be big.
Good. Go see that movie.
So that's more than, it's more than like a tug. Remember I was talking about the tug?
Yeah.
And it feels like more than a tug. It feels like you have to do this.
Yeah. Kathy Valentine. Well, I'm glad that we're friends. I'm glad you came over.
Yeah, and I'm really glad. You're my favorite Austin person, I think.
Thank you. You're very, very high up. I have a lot of favorite
Austin
people.
Yeah, I got
people.
A lot
you're
of them, too.
You're definitely one of my favorite Austin people.
I don't
want
to exclude people, but
no, no,
you're in the echelon. You're
good.
In the
so
pantheon.
The top.
Of
yeah, pantheons.
Yes.
Likewise. Well, thank you for coming over to my place and talking to me. And I guess people can find out about the Blue Bonnets at thebluebonnets.net.
.net, yeah. And there's kathyvalentine.com.
Yes.
And Kathy Valentine Official on Facebook. And, Kathy,
and follow her on Twitter.
Kathy_Valentine on Twitter.
You're a very active tweeter.
Yeah, I love Twitter.
Yeah.
Love the Twitter.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
Everyone enjoy this.
If you tell me where I can
All right, so that was my conversation with Kathy Valentine. I'm glad she was able to come by. It's a great song, Vacation. And really, I was a huge Go-Go's fan. I still am. I'm friends with Charlotte and Jane and Kathy. And they're all great people. I've worked with them. And they're great people, great musicians, and a lot of fun to hang out with. Kathy is a very, very special person, very dear to me. So I'm glad that she was able to come by. Anyone out there having a good time? That's what I want to know. All right, so here's some more Kathy Valentine music. This is from her solo album. I hope you guys, I hope you have a great day. I hope you enjoyed Kathy, and stay safe out there. I'll see you at episode 19.
It's not what you said. It's not what you did. It's who you love.